Once council is ready, if you'll come forward and please state your name for the record. If you wish to reserve any time, please acknowledge for the record.
Good morning, Justices, Mr. Bateman. I am Susan Burke, and I represent the appellant, Kevin Rodriguez. If it pleases the court, I would like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. After reviewing the briefs in this appeal, I concluded that I would concentrate on issue B. That's the issue involving the admission of text messages, as that issue appears to be an issue of first impression in this jurisdiction. If the court would prefer that I address another issue, however, I would be happy to do so.
Please begin your argument, and we'll jump in where appropriate.
Okay. First, I would like to begin with some facts from the record. It appears in this case that the state does not dispute the fact that the co-defendant, Timothy Sanders, was the leader and generally primary actor in the incidents at issue in this case, and that Kevin Rodriguez, my client, was following Mr. Sanders' commands. They discussed this extensively in their closing argument at the trial. Also, from the CAT bus video, it apparently depicts these two, and it is clear that Mr. Rodriguez at no time in that video is in possession of the cell phone at issue, and therefore he is definitely not entering text into the phone. The video shows that the two got on the bus at approximately 1:25 and left at approximately 1:36. Based on the timing of the messages, only two of those messages were sent while the two were on the bus. The first two messages, both of which were rather innocuous. One said, "Willie boy, you better %100, I don't know what that means," and then, "Willie, do you love me?" There is no evidence but pure speculation that any of the messages were sent by the two together after they left the bus. In its closing argument, the state talked about the fact that the text about "we just effed your bitch" was sent while they were on the bus, but that's incorrect. The only two that were sent were the two that I just mentioned. Now, although several times the state makes various assertions about the trial court's findings concerning the admissibility of the messages, like that they qualified as a direct admission of Mr. Rodriguez, this is simply belied by the record. As I pointed out in the reply brief, the court never specified the rationale for letting these messages come in at the trial, other than referring to the totality of the circumstances. She said to the state something like, "So you're going to do 2 + 2 = 4 and the totality of the circumstances," and then she overruled the objection. Therefore, I submit there's no real deference to be given the trial court's rulings in this case. Now, I would like to look at the possible legal bases for admission of these text messages. According to Section 17 of 116 AMJUR Proof of Facts, 3rd, 345, the following things would be necessary to be admissible as a text message or any other kind of electronically stored information. It must be, (1), relevant. It must be, (2), authentic. It must be not hearsay or admissible under an exception to the rule barring hearsay evidence. It must be an original or a duplicate. It must be admissible as secondary evidence to prove its contents, and the probity value must outweigh its prejudicial effect. In other words, it's pretty much like any other kind of evidence that would be admissible. Excuse me. In this particular case, relevancy, authenticity, except as to who was actually the author of the text, and the best evidence rule are not really at issue. I submit that the primary issue is the hearsay issue. And of course, there's always probity value versus prejudicial impact in any kind of admissibility determination. Now, hearsay, obviously, is an oral or written assertion offered to prove the truth of the matter and is generally considered inadmissible. The state does not argue that the messages at issue would not normally fit the definition of a hearsay. Instead, it relies on NRS 51.0353 for excluding from hearsay statements that are offered against a party. Now, the ways that the messages could fit into that exclusion category in this case would be, number one, if Mr. Rodriguez has made a statement himself, if it was his own direct admission. Number two, if the statements of the co-conspirator were made during the course of the conspiracy and in the furtherance of a conspiracy, and see if the statements were adoptive admissions. Now, as to a direct admissions, the state says there's sufficient evidence for the court to find that they were direct admissions of Mr. Rodriguez, but I submit that absent speculation, this is just not true. The state talks about the fact that they were apparently conferring on the bus. There was no evidence that Mr. Rodriguez was ever directly texting or dictating texts while they were on the bus. And this is not surprising in light of his role as the follower in this incident and the fact that he had significant mental health issues. For a time, he was even considered incompetent to go to trial in this case. The use of the term "we" is also not persuasive in a later text message, because a person could use that term to diminish his own personal liability for an activity without indicating that it was a joint effort. For example, if one defendant makes an out-of-court assertion that tends to implicate the other person, then we may run into a Bruton issue, and that's where that line of case law came from. So clearly the fact that one of the texts used the term "we," I don't think is sufficient to show any sort of direct admission on Mr. Rodriguez's part.
Is not the jury allowed to determine that use of the term "we"? I understand your position as to it, but as to a jury, what is their ability?
I think that there's a threshold issue to be determined by the court in terms of whether or not this gets to the jury. And I think that, therefore, it's up to the court as the gatekeeper of what can come in to make that preliminary determination. That would be my position. They talk about the fact that later on, one of the messages I said, I think, says something like, "Yeah, we just such and such," or "Yeah, such and such." Again, this is not something that I think, when you've got something this crucial, is sufficient to show any sort of direct admission on Mr. Rodriguez's part. Now, Jeremy Sanders said both he and Kevin Rodriguez had the phone briefly the next day. But any evidence that he had temporary possession of the phone the next day, the phone itself the next day, is insufficient to prove that he directly sent the messages or that he was even aware of them. If you have a cell phone and you don't go to the messages section, they don't just automatically pop up in front of you. Now, as to the statements of a co-conspirator made during and in the course of a conspiracy and in furtherance of the conspiracy, the state doesn't argue and appears to concede that the text would not be admissible under that ground. These statements were in no way in furtherance of a conspiracy. If anything, they were revealing the conspiracy and or admissions, and therefore they could not be admissible for that purpose. I would submit that most of the arguments on this issue concern the admissibility of the text's adoptive admissions. There are two kinds of adoptive admissions, express adoption and implied adoption. According to the Criminal Evidentiary Foundation's second edition by M. Winkle, Reed, and Blinka, the following foundations are involved in these two kinds of admissions. If it's an express adoption of a statement, it requires that the declarant make a statement, that the statement be made in the party's presence, the other party's presence, the other party heard and understood the statement, and the party made a statement that expressed agreement with the declarant's statement. I submit to you that the text messages in this particular case do not fit in that category, or do not make that foundation. Now, as to an implied adoption or a tacit admission,
counsel,
I'm sorry.
I understand what you just read, but are we now limited, as we now exist in this text message age, with your explicit reading of that rule? Or should our interpretation look at how that rule functions within the world we now exist in?
Well, I think it becomes even more important in the world that we now exist in that we make sure that if we're going to hold someone to have adopted someone else's text message, that at a very minimum, we have to establish that we're aware of that message and in some way or another decided to agree with that message.
Does that then go to the issue that you touched upon earlier, the court looking at the totality of the situation to make that determination or the consideration of the totality?
Well, I think that before you can, for example, if I sent a text message to someone else where I said something negative about the Nevada Supreme Court, and then someone tried to say that you agreed with that statement, you would want to make sure before anyone held you to that statement that you were aware that I had made it and that you had some sort of opportunity to respond to it. Now, as far as the implied or tacit admission, you have to show that the declarant made a statement, that the statement was an accusation against the party opponent, that the declarant made the statement in the party's presence, that the party heard and understood the statement, and that the party had an opportunity to deny the statement. The party either remained silent or made an evasive or equivocal reply. Under similar circumstances, an innocent person would have immediately denied. I believe Nevada's law is consistent with that. As discussed in the opening brief, to qualify as an express adoptive admission, it must be a statement that the person manifested his adoption of belief in the truth of the statement. Clearly, I just don't think there's any evidence in this case that Mr. Rodriguez did that.
Counselor, you're into your rebuttal time at this point.
Yes, I see that.
Could I ask one question, though, while you're on the subject of adoptive admission? The Ninth Circuit in Ospina and Carrillo adopt a slightly more relaxed standard in the context of possession of a cell phone. Could you address the application of those cases and whether this court should adopt the rules enunciated in those cases in resolving the admission of these text messages?
I think it's very dangerous to suggest that by possessing a cell phone, you're in possession of the text messages that are in that, especially in this day with young people. They just switch cell phones and borrow cell phones, and I certainly even borrow cell phones, and I would hate to be held to the standard that because I had
someone... I don't think the Ninth Circuit cases say possession alone provides a basis for admissibility. The way I understand the test is that it's possession plus some other action on the part of the defendant that demonstrates an adoption. Now, I don't know whether the facts in this case support some other action that makes it admissible, perhaps the ride on the bus, perhaps other evidence in the case would support that. But nevertheless, my question is, should this court entertain such a rule as seems to be fairly well adopted, at least in the Ninth Circuit?
Obviously, possession is significant to consider, but I think that until and unless you have a significant nexus to the text messages, in other words, I think if you're going to take that position and have that rule, whatever additional evidence is necessary must show at a minimum that the person was aware that the text message is...
Well, if I'm sitting right next to the person who's doing the texting on a bus, even though it's only two of the messages, that seems like you get a little close to what the Ninth Circuit's talking about, doesn't it?
As to the two on the bus, I can see that, but neither of those on the bus were admissions damning in any way harmful.
Let me ask you this. Suppose the panel were to agree that these are not admissible and that there was error in admitting them. Is it harmless?
I would say it's not harmless, and I would say it's not harmless specifically because of the issue I raised in Issue A, where the prosecutor felt compelled in closing argument to tell the jury, if you think there's a difference in the evidence between these two, don't worry about it. The judge will take care of that at sentencing. If the state felt compelled to make that argument, I think that's probably the best argument, that there was not overwhelming evidence of guilt as far as Mr. Rodriguez went. And because there was not, I would say the admission of these, along with the other errors that I complained about.
Well, he was convicted of a lot of different counts. Which count do you think that error applies to? All of them? The sexual assault counts? I guess I'm a little bit troubled by the suggestion that the harmless error standard affects all the counts equally. It would seem like there is quite a bit of evidence to demonstrate Rodriguez's culpability in some of these accounts, regardless of the text message admissibility question.
I understand your concern, and I would think that it would, particularly since a lot of them related to the sexual assault, I think it would be particularly damning as to that because there was no evidence that Mr. Rodriguez directly participated in that.
Okay. Thanks, Sorry. Justice Douglas, for accommodating the question.
Not a problem. We will give you your 4 minutes since we chewed up your time. Counsel, on behalf of the state.
May it please the court, good morning. My name is Sam Baker. I'm a deputy district attorney. I'll be representing the state today. And like Ms. Burke, we were trial counsel. Obviously, I'll address specifically the text messages, which seem to be somewhat of a unique issue for this court and were keyed in on. I note the term world we exist in. I think that in doing some research on this particular case, I think we are seeing a situation where emails become a greater part of the evidence in cases. Text messages and electronic media, which makes it somewhat difficult at times to prove 100% that a particular person drafted an email or a text message. I don't believe that the law requires us, in order to introduce that evidence for jury consideration, to meet a level that I think the appellant is asking us to meet in this particular case. I think that there is a threshold question that every trial court has to address for all evidence across the spectrum. And whether it meets, whether it's authentic, whether there's sufficient foundation, that it is what it purports to be. There is, and I know Ms. Burke referenced some treatises, I would reference one as well. And this one would be Weinstein's Federal Evidence, Section 901.023, and I apologize for it not being in the brief. But it says, a proponent of offered evidence need not rule out all possibilities inconsistent with authenticity or conclusively prove that the evidence is what it purports to be. Rather, the proponent must provide sufficient proof for a reasonable juror to find the evidence is what it purports to be. The facts in this case, I think, are actually quite relevant. This is not a case of what happened. This is actually a case of ID, and I think if you look at the totality of the evidence in the case, you would agree. What ended up happening in this case is shortly after the events took place regarding the victim, and after this BlackBerry was stolen, the text messages began being sent from the stolen BlackBerry to the victim's boyfriend. And that would have had to have been based on looking at past text messages, which are saved on the telephone, and for the person making these text messages to discern that that was a boyfriend and understand what the contents of the text messages were. The evidence in this case was before the victim could even make a 911 call, the co-defendant, Mr. Sanders, ended up on a video using the victim's ATM card. And he was looking out the window, kind of obviously communicating with someone outside. Literally between 5 and 10 minutes later, they're at the second convenience store, and this is when we see Mr. Rodriguez come in with what I believe to be, was testified to as the victim's car keys. Again, the car was taken, the cell phone was taken, the ATM card was taken. And so what ended up happening over this very short course of time is that these two individuals were seen together shortly after the events. They generally matched the description, although it wasn't a particularly extensive description of the assailants because it was dark and under the circumstances that it took place. And then they made their way all the way to a bus stop where the CAT bus recorded these two individuals in the back of the bus looking at or doing something with a cell phone, which was obvious from the video. And then after that period of time, these two individuals are seen together the next day, which was testified to by Mr. Sanders, the co-defendant's brother, and on that next day, after these two individuals arrived with the new clothes, which the inference would be that these were from the proceeds of the robbery, that Mr. Rodriguez was indeed handling the cell phone, and that there were pictures of Mr. Rodriguez on the cell phone. So if you take into consideration from start to finish the evidence that would relate to both of these individuals constructively possessing the cell phone, and then on top of it tie in what the contents of the text messages were, and I would submit that it's not necessarily the case that all text messages necessarily were offered for the truth of the matter asserted. Some of them could have been. Certainly the we did what we said we did could absolutely be treated as offered for the truth of the matter asserted. And then the argument that you were discussing, whether there's a hearsay exception or whether it's non-hearsay under 51035 is an admission or an adopted admission, is relevant. But the other statements were not necessarily to be taken for their truth. Some of those statements were, Willie, go over and save your girlfriend that we tied up. But it was to show identification. The only people that could have made those statements and known what was consistent with what the victim had testified to were the people who had the cell phone, and therefore were the people that stole the cell phone, and therefore were the people that were in the apartment doing what the victim said they did. We perhaps at the trial level did not do as good a job as we should have in delineating each and every text message for whether it was offered for its truth, whether it was offered more as an identification tool of the defendants in this particular case, or whether it was, and then therefore, you know, whether it was an adoptive admission or an admission.
One of the things that troubles me, Mr. Bateman, in this area is that authenticity is in this technological area is increasingly important. We apply pretty rigorous standards to authenticity of records or documents as exceptions to the hearsay rule, and here we have circumstances where we're trying to establish by circumstantial evidence the operator of the cell phone. Should this rule be one in which the court makes a threshold determination and then the jury instructed on whether to make it a separate determination as to whether the user of the phone is in fact the person that is identified? Because you're making this a circumstantial case essentially on whether Rodriguez at least is operating the cell phone.
I don't believe that a separate instruction is necessary. I think that I do believe that the trial, I don't know that I would necessarily be opposed to the concept. I think the trial court is indeed the gatekeeper of the evidence and hears the evidence to determine whether that threshold is met such that the parties can introduce the evidence and then at the end of the trial can make whatever arguments they intend to make to the jury. I will submit that Ms. Burke made excellent arguments that Mr. Rodriguez had nothing to do with the cell phone. I don't know that necessarily the jury agreed with her or didn't. It goes back to your question about harmless error. I believe there was evidence otherwise that would have required a conviction. But I think that it is sufficient that the court determination as to the evidence that the state is offering, and it can be done through an evidentiary hearing, it can be done through an offer of proof, and make a determination as to whether that evidence amounts to a level to then provide it to a jury to make the determination as to who sent those text messages and what weight to give those text messages based upon the party's arguments. I'm not saying that we couldn't craft a jury instruction that might aid in that determination. I'm not sure that it's necessary. I believe that the court did make that determination in this case. We had a discussion on the record about what it is the state was going to prove or intended to prove in this particular case with reference to the text messages. I think any time you have, if we're talking about a statement by a defendant, if the state is offering a statement by what it believes to be a defendant and is therefore non-hearsay as an admission by a party opponent, in an ID case that somewhat becomes difficult because the defendant is saying, I'm not the one, therefore I'm not the one that made the statement. Therefore,
I guess what worries me is a hypothetical like this. Suppose Sanders sends a text message, Rodriguez isn't on the bus. Sanders is there by himself. But he sends a text message that says, in effect, hi, I'm Rodriguez, and I raped your girlfriend. That seems to me to be a problem for admissibility.
That issue would then have to be addressed as to whether the evidence in the case is sufficient to lay the foundation that text message is what it purports to be. Mm-hmm. And in that particular case, we may view the evidence differently. A court may be more concerned about based upon the contents of the text message and what it is offering. And I think that's why the district court probably is in the best position to make that threshold call. Obviously, we didn't have that to that extent in this particular case, and that's to some extent why I fall back.
Well, maybe not to that extent, but to a lesser degree you do, because as counsel suggests, only two of the text messages occurred during the time that the bus video was operating. The more offensive, I guess, is a better way to put it, text messages, maybe the more implicating text messages for your case on ID, text messages that would implicate the defendants because of their knowledge of the specifics of the crime occurred outside of the scope of that video. And so it really is uncertain about who is transmitting those text messages.
I would think in this particular case, and I think it probably would be a very fact-specific case, again, the court would allow that evidence to be presented to the jury and then allow both parties to argue what that evidence means. I think in this particular case, to answer your hypothetical, the evidence showed that the two individuals, the defendants, got off the bus together, and the next day were seen together with each other, within 24 hours. Both individuals were testified to as by the defendant's brother, the co-defendant's brother, someone that might have some, bias in the case, but to lie, if you will, for both of them, actually testified that both, his name is Jeremy Sanders. Jeremy Sanders handled the phone, Timothy Sanders, the co-defendant, handled the phone, and Mr. Rodriguez handled the phone. If you have evidence to suggest, my point would be, if I have evidence to suggest that Mr. Rodriguez, after the fact, is handling a cellular phone that has text messages on it, has photographs of him on it, and arguably by inference, we had evidence that Mr. Rodriguez were taking photos with this phone, which would show then that he has knowledge generally of how to work a BlackBerry. I think that it would be a fair indication. It would be fair to present it to the jury when Mr. Rodriguez had possession of that phone to be able to say Mr. Rodriguez would have either, one, drafted that, your hypothetical, drafted the text message that was sent, or would have had an opportunity to reject that under the adopted admission standard.
See it and reject it.
And again, that would all go to weight, and that argument could be made to the jury. If we didn't have that additional evidence after the bus trip of the two being together and of Mr. Rodriguez handling that phone subsequent to what we saw on the CAT bus, I would say that it might be a little closer case and that the district court would be in the best position to address that issue and preclude it if there was insufficient foundation.
Can you address harmless error?
At the end of the day, when you look at how these two individuals were tracked on the videos by the ATM records and by the text messages, I think that what you end up having is very, very close in time. Two individuals matching the description of what occurred, using the proceeds of the robbery, and in possession of even all the way to the bus stop, either in actual or constructive possession of the proceeds, that being, in this particular case, the phone, that a reasonable jury absolutely could conclude, absent the contents of the phone, that Mr. Rodriguez and Mr. Sanders were the ones that were in the apartment in question. I think that it is important evidence, that the contents of the text messages to show identification, but such short in time possession and continued possession of the contents or the proceeds of the robbery and the fact that these two individuals were together for such a long period of time after that fact would be sufficient evidence for a jury to convict both Mr. Rodriguez and Mr. Sanders. So even if some of those text messages were entered into evidence improperly, and I wouldn't concede that any of them were, but I think that we would still have sufficient evidence to convict them of all the charges, because I don't think in the actual room that evidence was really greatly contested about what actually happened between the victim and the two assailants. It was actually probably a little bit more contested by the co-defendant, but again, I don't think that this case turned on what actually, whether there was a dispute as to the underlying facts of what occurred to the victim. It was basically who did it after the fact and how we tracked them down through really a rather unique set of evidence that ended up being able to be collected going forward.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Burke, we chewed into your time. We'll give you the full 4 minutes that you asked for.
I'd like to first address the Ninth Circuit decisions a little bit. Although I'm not familiar with them all, I have a feeling from the other decisions that I have been able to find that they didn't involve this unique circumstance where you had two people and you were adopting someone else's thing. In other words, if you're possessing the phone and you're the only one at issue and you're talking about something that only you knew on the text, then I could see where possession of the phone might be much more significant. But I think when you're talking about possessing the phone and then saying that therefore you are adopting what's in the text messages without proof that you knew that they were there is very problematic. The other problem is, how do you disavow something, an accusation that's made in a text message, unless you, number one, obviously know that the message is there. Number two, you'd have to take the phone and thus get possession of it in order to send another message back disavowing the previous message. And as far as I know, they don't have an app for that yet. Maybe they can just put a button on these phones that say disavow and sort of get done with that. I think the other thing is...
That was a clever comment.
Pardon?
That was a clever comment.
Thank you. I have to inject a little humor in here. I think there's also, the state made mention of, well, Mr. Rodriguez likely took pictures of the phone so he knew how a BlackBerry worked, so he knew what the text messages were there. Well, the state's well aware that there were several people there the day that these pictures were taken, and it's just speculation that Mr. Rodriguez took them, and it's also speculation that that indicates he knew how to use a BlackBerry. I think you get to a point where things are just so far attenuated that it's no longer probative. And obviously, you've got to have probative value to satisfy any sort of admissibility. Now, if I could sort of summarize, I think that in this particular case, the evidence is insufficient to show several things. One, it's insufficient to show that Kevin Rodriguez directly authored the messages at issue. We have absolutely no proof of that. The only proof we have of direct authorship is that video from the bus that clearly shows phone in Timothy Sanders' possession and Timothy Sanders doing some sort of what appears to be texting. We also have insufficient evidence that he directly adopted the messages as his own. There's just nothing that indicates that he did that expressly. And with one possible exception, the messages were not anything that he needed to disavow. The only possible exception would be the one about having just raped his girlfriend. And again, I submit there's no way for him to have disavowed that, and we have no way of knowing. That message was sent, I believe, well over an hour after they left the bus. So we don't even have any knowledge that they were together at that time.
Counsel, query, though, as your prior, could a reasonable jury conclude, just based upon their proximity, that that's possible? I know you said it's not, but could a reasonable juror, which is the standard, make an assumption based upon what was introduced, that these two individuals were together, whatever the video showed, conversing or not conversing on the bus. It doesn't disavow, but is it possible a reasonable juror could understand or make that leap, as you're saying?
I think inferences, if I might finish.
Go ahead.
Inferences have to be reasonable. And I think under these circumstances where you've got something so critical, I mean, these text messages were devastating, I think, in terms of their content. And when you have something like that, I think the court has to perform its gatekeeping function. I don't think they should have gotten to the jury. And I don't think that just because they were on the bus, if you're going to make that kind of a leap of logic, I think it is no longer a reasonable inference. I think it gets into the area of speculation.
Well, counsel, to use kind of your analogy, since we don't know because the tape was muted what was being said between the parties, can we rule out the reasonable juror could have conjectured that these two people talked about what the texts were going to be, the totality, which is an acceptable standard? Go ahead and answer.
Possibly for the while they're on the bus, but I don't think that carries over. And the quality of the text and the tone of the text were so different afterward than they were at that time. I think that makes a difference, too. Everybody appears to have formed the opinion that it was the co-defendant that raped this woman. And the tone of the texts are much more likely to have come from that person, I submit.
Counsel, if I could ask one further question. You seem to concede that your client was aware of the texting, at least the act of texting, while he was on the bus with respect to the two texts that were involved. The state suggests that the purpose for the admissibility of the text messages was to effectuate identity in this case. Would those two text messages have been admissible, and should the district court have given some limiting instruction as to their use with respect to what was communicated, the purpose being for identity?
I don't necessarily concede the point, but I do concede that a reasonable juror could determine from the video that these were the people that were on
the
bus.
If the state's argument was, look, at least these first two text messages that were transmitted while the two of them are on this bus should be admitted for purposes of demonstrating identity of these two perpetrators, would that have made them admissible?
I suppose I would have a hard time arguing against that, but I think that the quality, like again, the tone and the content of the messages were so different later and so much more related to someone who would have been the aggressor as Mr.
Sure.
Sanders was describing.
Well, you understand that the other messages are pretty inflammatory and could create some other difficulties, but at least with respect to the two.
I would, of course, argue that he could have been dissuading him from doing it as well as helping him do it on the bus.
Sure.
I mean, but that would have been my argument, and I think it may have even been my argument. I can't remember right now at trial. But that one's a much closer call than the rest, I would say.
Great. Thank you.
Ms. Burke, Mr. Bateman, thank you for the arguments this morning. Thank you as to the familiarity with your record, as well as the case law in this matter. The matter will stand submitted. We're in recess until 11:30 in our next argument.